The author P.D. James has a definition of detective fiction that is as neatly constructed as one of her mystery novels.
What we have is a central mysterious crime, which is usually murder. We have a closed circle of suspects with means, motive and opportunity for the crime. We have a detective who can be amateur or professional, who comes in rather like an avenging deity to solve it. And by the end, we do get a solution.
P.D. James has been writing detective fiction for nearly half a century. Her latest book is about her craft. It's called Talking About Detective Fiction, and it's a very personal and affectionate look at the art, the evolution, and the conventions of the mystery novel. Take, for example, the central character.
The detective can know nothing which the reader isn't also told. It would be a very, very bad detective story at the end if the reader felt, well, who could possibly have guessed that? What one wants the reader to feel was that that was very clever. I didn't guess it, but I should have guessed it. Now I see. I see where I went wrong. But sometimes I think people, they don't keep their mind very much on the clues. They get too interested in the action and in the characters.
I was wondering about that. Do you think that your definition for the bones of a detective story, do you think that's changed much over the years?
Well, I don't think it's changed much with the detective story, although there are different emphases, and the detective story has moved much straighter, closer to the straighter novel. And it's much less an entirely just a puzzle and nothing more than a puzzle. I mean, in the Golden Age, what was important was that you had an original method of death. People were killed in most extraordinary ways. But nowadays, I think we look for greater realism. It's interesting if you can have an original method of death, but the book should be realistic and the people should be realistic. So I think we are trying to be truer to life and also to say something about the society in which we live.
I'd like to go back to that phrase you used, the Golden Age. The Golden Age of detective fiction is generally regarded as the couple of decades between the First and Second World Wars. This was a time when lots of people started writing, I gather, in their spare time and produced a lot of very clever, very witty crime fiction of a certain kind.
One gets the impression they were writing for their own entertainment as much as for the entertainment of the readers, and I think they were enjoying it greatly, and the books are ingenious and often very funny, and they've lasted, which is interesting.
That is interesting. The four women authors who stand out for you, Agatha Christie, Dorothy Sayers, Marjorie Allingham, and I have no idea how to pronounce.
Well, I think it's Nio.
That's why I thought it was Nio. Nio,
yes,
Marsh.
You're absolutely right, Nio.
From New Zealand. I mean, their books are all in print.
And they are
still read. What do you think was their influence?
Well, I think that they showed that it was important to write well. Dorothy L. Sayers wrote extremely well, for example, so that they lifted a rather despised genre into a form which could be taken seriously. Then they were very ingenious. They're very clever in their plotting. And we do care very much about their heroes. Of course, their heroes are as different from a real-life detective as they could possibly be.
Did their choice of how to create a character affect your choice when you set out to create your character, your detective?
I'm not sure it did, except for Dorothy L. Sayers. I think I was quite strongly influenced by her, by the structure and the plotting and by the quality of the writing. I wasn't influenced at all by Agatha Christie. I read her with great pleasure, but it seemed to me that she was basically a puzzler. At the end of the book, you put it away thinking, well, how clever that was, but knowing that it couldn't possibly happen in real life. We're in Christie land, which is a very good place to be, but it's not reality. It's a different kind of reality.
So you,
I think Dorothy
you were
L.
shooting.
Says she was trying to write about the society in which she lived and about reasonable detection, I think.
And that's what you did with your hero, who's...
His name is Dalgleish. I named him after my English teacher at school. And in fact, it is a Scottish name.
Were you sort of thinking in terms of Agatha Christie and Dorothy Sayers and the others and thinking, you know, I've got to have somebody here that I like?
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think that I had a warning too from Dorothy L. Sayers and from Agatha Christie. Be very careful to create someone who isn't too eccentric, someone who can develop and develop in ways that you may not now even know about. But do give him the qualities that you admire. I don't think I actually believed or imagined that I'd end up being an international best-selling writer of detective fiction, but I began with it because I liked it so much myself. I thought I could do it, and I thought it would be a wonderful apprenticeship for someone setting out to be a serious writer. So I didn't necessarily think there would be a serial, but I felt, well, there might be, so who shall, what sort of man, you know, shall I create? And I gave him the personal qualities that I very much admire. And I made him courageous but not foolhardy, very intelligent, sensitive and compassionate but not sentimental. And he has, in fact, developed. I haven't had to change him drastically in any way.
Do you think that detective fiction is progressing? I mean, do you think it's as good as, say, it was in the Golden Age?
Yes, indeed I do. It's interesting that the orthodox detective story, written very much within the same conventions, is being written and written very well. I think we are entering a second golden age, and that wouldn't be surprising because the theory is that the mystery flourishes best in times of acute anxiety and depression, and we're certainly in a very depressed state at the moment.
Well, I would assume that that is happening because in times of stress, people like something that is resolved.
I think that's probably the main reason, because we do have at the heart a mystery which is at the end solved, and it's not solved by good luck or divine intervention. It's solved by a human being, by human courage and human intelligence and human perseverance. So it's, in a sense, the detective story is a small celebration of reason and order in our very disorderly world.
Author P.D. James. Her new book is called Talking About Detective Fiction. You can read an excerpt at npr.org. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris. The healthcare overhaul is moving forward in fits and starts, even as Republicans use every rule in the book to delay a final vote. That vote is expected on Christmas Eve. Late last night, the longest night of the year, lights burned bright in the Senate. In the early hours today, Democrats proved they have 60 votes, enough to thwart a GOP filibuster. NPR's David Wellna has the latest.
In a roll call vote at 1:01 this morning, just as Senate Democratic leaders had predicted, all 60 members of the Democratic caucus came down in favor of ending a GOP filibuster of the health care bill. Dick Durbin, the Senate's number two Democrat, hailed that strictly party-line outcome this afternoon on the Senate floor.
I think when the history of the United States Senate is written, this vote will be included, because it is an historic vote.
The vote cleared the way for approval of a so-called manager's amendment pieced together by Majority Leader Harry Reid. It's a measure chock full of deals he cut with individual senators and interest groups to win support for the bill. Reid was making no apologies today for practicing what he called the art of compromise.
Never have we been so close to reforming America's broken health insurance system. We're not over the finish line, but we would never have gotten this far without the support of doctors, nurses, medical professionals.
Alongside Reid at a Capitol news conference stood Dr. Cecil Wilson, president-elect of the American Medical Association. Wilson announced the AMA had decided to support the Senate's health care bill after getting several items it wanted in Reid's manager's amendment.
For example, the bill increases payments to primary care physicians and general surgeons in underserved areas while no longer cutting payments to other physicians. It eliminates the tax on physician services for cosmetic surgery and drops the proposed physician enrollment fee for Medicare.
Now, that might sound like Senate Democrats gave in to a special interest group, but at the White House today, President Obama portrayed his former colleagues as having done exactly the opposite.
By standing up to the special interests who've prevented reform for decades and who are furiously lobbying against it now, the Senate has moved us closer to reform that makes a tremendous difference for families, for seniors, for businesses, and for the country as a whole.
Not surprisingly, Senate Republicans disagree. Here's John Cornyn of Texas slamming the health care bill today on the Senate floor.
Rather than making decisions about what's best for the American people, this deal has been driven by deals with special interest groups and lobbyists. And rather than listen to constituents, individual senators have decided that their votes should be traded for tax dollars and other sweetheart benefits that go to their states.
One such benefit went to Nebraska Democrat Ben Nelson. He pledged support for the bill after being promised that expanded Medicaid coverage in his state would be paid for permanently by the federal government. Today, Nebraska Republican Mike Johanns denounced that deal.
Nebraskans are frustrated and angry that our beloved state has been thrust into the same pot with all of the other special deals that got cut here.
Republicans accuse Democrats of ignoring recent polls showing rising opposition to the health care legislation. But Iowa Democrat Tom Harkin says he's not worried about a voter backlash.
Once we get this done and the American public sees what's really happening and get rid of all this yakety yak and all the tomfoolery around here, people are going to see that we did a good thing.
Republicans would like to drag out voting on the bill as long as they can. Again, Texas Republican John Cornyn.
Mr. President, this debate is not over. There's still a chance to vote against this bill.
By most calculations, a final vote could come late on Christmas Eve. David Wellner, NPR News, the Capitol.
Now the latest from the world of dinosaurs. If the thought of a razor-toothed dinosaur ripping into its prey is not scary enough, consider a venomous one. That's what some scientists are proposing after discovering an unusual fossil in China. NPR's Christopher Joyce has that story.
Cynornithosaurus was petite as dinosaurs go. Think of a turkey with teeth. It ran with a tough crowd, though. It was cousin to the oh-so-scary Velociraptor of Jurassic Park fame. Paleontologist David Burnham from the University of Kansas and a Chinese colleague were puzzled by a 125-million-year-old Cynornithosaurus in a museum, specifically by its upper teeth.
And we finally realized we're looking at the outside of these teeth, and they're grooved. And we both look at each other and go, what? Why would a animal have grooved teeth?
It turns out some venomous snakes and lizards use grooved teeth to deliver poison. Burnham thinks this dinosaur did too. Besides the teeth, another clue was a cavity in the jawbone where, he suggests, a venom gland could have been. He also found a channel leading from the cavity to ducts near some of the teeth. These teeth are about 3 inches long. Unlike the hypodermic-type teeth of a viper, they're farther back, where our premolars would be. That's much the same as rear-fanged snakes and lizards living now. Burnham says the teeth and jaw of the animal were too frail for a grab-and-gulp strategy like big carnivores. Instead, it might have employed a grab-and-hold technique, like the Gila monster of the American Southwest.
They grab onto you and they don't let go. So they just got a vice grip on your hand or whatever they can grab from you, and that's enough to get the venom, you know, into your tissues.
The animal essentially chews the venom into the wound. Burnham describes Cynornithosaurus in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. He can't tell what kind of venom the creature might have had, but if it were like the rear-fanged venomous animals alive today, he thinks it would immobilize rather than kill, so its prey could be eaten more leisurely.
They lived in these forests, most probably lived in trees, or hunted from trees anyways, and so anything that they could get a hold of, perhaps a small lizard or a mammal as well, would be just fine.
The debut of a new kind of dinosaur, especially one so radically endowed, usually brings out skeptics. Paleontologist Tom Holtz of the University of Maryland says he's not convinced yet.
They give a number of different physical features which they interpret as signs of poison or poison delivery systems, but which, in my opinion, are more easily interpreted in other types of biological contexts.
For example, Holt says many dinosaurs have a cavity in their jawbone, probably to hold an air sac for cooling. He says the grooves could be something else, maybe wear and tear. But Burnham says he's found more fossils with grooved teeth. He says that when he goes back to China, he'll be looking at dinosaur teeth a lot more closely than he used to. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
One year ago today, a huge earthen dam burst outside Kingston, Tennessee. The dam was part of a holding pond for a power plant, and when it collapsed, it sent a torrent of coal ash into a river and smothered hundreds of acres in the countryside. Almost every day since, workers have scooped up thousands of tons of ash. But one year into a cleanup that's expected to cost $1 billion, the Tennessee Valley Authority says it still doesn't know where it will put all that sludge. Daniel Potter of member station WPLN reports.
Work never ends at the Kingston site. Dredges siphon muck out of the Emory River into a channel where massive yellow backhoes scoop out glistening piles of dark ash. The sludge is what's left over after coal is burned for energy and dumped in a holding pond. The site employs hundreds, and Tennessee Valley Authority environmental manager Dennis Yankee says the cleanup is nonstop.
Dredging is 24/6. What we're finding is the seventh day is it's a maintenance day. We got all this equipment. Oil changes alone become pretty intimidating.
TVA calls dredging the river the time-critical phase of the cleanup. The Environmental Protection Agency has found high levels of arsenic and selenium in the river. But the TVA says drinking water downstream is safe. Roan County residents like Doug Rose are skeptical.
I've noticed that we'd cook something every now and then. The water would smell different when you'd cook it, even whatever you're cooking in.
The volunteer firefighter says he's fished these rivers for years, but it's gotten harder to catch anything since the spill, and he sees fewer boats on the lake. And then there's the tap water at home.
And we live maybe, 12 miles away from the steam plant, and it's bad our way. And, I mean, all the water goes the same direction.
TVA expects to finish dredging the river by next spring, and by the end of the year it will have shipped all that ash by train to a landfill in Perry County, Alabama. So far, Perry County is only getting the ash that spilled into the river. Another 1.4 million tons remain on land. TVA says it will clean that up too, but hasn't decided what to do with the ash.
That still is a significant outstanding issue.
That's Stephen Smith of the TVA watchdog group Southern Alliance for Clean Energy.
We're now a year into this, and the fact that TVA continues to not have a long-term option for that, I think, is unacceptable.
Smith also says the Environmental Protection Agency has not done enough since the accident to safeguard other holding ponds around the country. Last week, the EPA announced it would miss this year's deadline to issue new rules on coal ash. Craig Zeller is EPA project manager at Kingston. He says the sheer magnitude of the spill needed to be stabilized before recovery could get underway.
You know, using those medical terms of triage, the patient's been stable, you know, and now we're working on, you know, getting it back to life. So it's back up and walking, and that's going to take a little bit of time.
Zeller is overseeing the long-term restoration of native plants and animals to the site. He expects to be on the job for the next 5 years. For NPR News, I'm Daniel Potter in Nashville.
But first, an author who focuses his attention on the Chinese immigrant experience. Ha Jin knows a few things about immigrating to America. In 1985, he left his native China to attend Brandeis University. As a writer, Ha Jin has kept a literary eye trained on China. He's taken the Chinese experience and rendered it for American readers. Ha Jin's new book of short stories, A Good Fall, is set in one of the most American of cities, New York. Flushing, Queens, is home to one of New York's largest Chinese immigrant communities. In painting the portrait of this slice of society, Jin considers many generational perspectives and characters who are trying to discover their place in America. Ha Jin joins us from our member station, WBUR in Boston. Thank you so much for being a part of our show today.
Thank you. We're happy to be here.
You know, I've been your fan for years, and I spoke with you a couple of years ago about your book, A Free Life. And this was a novel about a young man who flees communist China in the 1980s, and he comes to the United States to study political science. And Nan Wu, the protagonist of this book, has been dreaming of this freedom. He reads poems, and it was lovely to learn that these were poems that you actually wrote in this really lengthy, over 600-page book. So might I just go back to a lesson to that classical immigrant dream of freedom that these poems embody?
You must go to a country without borders, where you can build your home out of a gallons of words, where broad leaves shade familiar faces that no longer change in wind and rain. There's no morning or evening, no cries of joy or pain. Every canyon is drenched in the light of serenity. You must go there quietly, leave behind what you still cherish.
So what I love about this is the whole notion of building your home out of gallons of words. And that's kind of what you have tried to do for these characters, because there's so much tension between cultures in this collection of stories, between each other, between their dreams and expectations, between the desire to assimilate and the really hard task of foregoing heritage, which is in a way impossible, isn't it?
Yes, a big struggle for every one of them. I think in essence, the main character in this book is in the struggle of looking for home, the first generation of immigrants. That's why it's very hard for them to feel at home. So that is very difficult. Even if they have a place to stay, but they don't have the feeling of being home.
Right. And of course, the way that the new world collides with the old can be as slight and yet somehow tethered as the internet. The collection begins with a story that takes place between two sisters over the internet and then goes into what happens when people really move in to the immigrant's home. Tell me about the characters in The Crossfire.
Oh, sure. The mother in that story can be somebody, a messenger from the native land, so the values are different. And so in that case, I think the clashes between the two places, the old land and the new place, become intensified. There was no way to reconcile.
This is a story in which the character is, am I pronouncing it right, Tian Chu?
Yes.
His mother has decided to come for an extended stay from China and has decided that his wife, Connie, is completely wrong for him because she won't cook.
Yeah, it's an old story. I think I have a lot of Jewish friends that will say the same thing. And the mother-in-law will say, no woman is good enough for her son. That's an old story. But in this situation like this, it becomes more manifest.
This all comes to a head in this family at this really tense dinner. The husband, the moment he got home, he went into the kitchen. He was going to cook a spinach soup, steam the eggplant, and fry the flounder. As he was gouging out the gill of the fish, his mother stepped in. Could you pick it up from there?
Let me give you a hand, she said. I can manage. This is easy, he smiled, cutting the fish's fins and tail with a large scissor. You never cook back home, she stared at him, her eyes glinting. What's the good of standing 6 feet tall if you can't handle a small woman like Connie? She often said. In fact, he was 5'10". He nudged his side of his bulky nose with his knuckle. Mom, in America, husband and wife both cook, whoever has the time. Connie is swamped with schoolwork these days, so I do more household chores. This is natural. No, it's not. You were never like this before. Why did you marry her in the first place if she wouldn't take care of you?
You know, who wouldn't just love having a relative visit like that?
That, I think, again, is normal. A lot of the details, in fact, I read them in newspapers, internet. Most of them, the complaints always came from women, but I never heard men speak about these things. That's why I got the idea, what if the story was told by a man?
And he becomes desperate to restore tranquility in the house, and without completely giving it away, can you talk about the measures to which he's willing to go?
He has to surprise or shock his mother with wrong piece of information that he have no job anymore. So as a result, she believed that he was totally bankrupt. So I think that's, again, there is based on misconception, a misunderstanding, because most people in the native lands would believe that the new immigrants could pick up cash right and left, everybody would be rich, and it was not like that at all.
What is it about Flushing, Queens, that made it the natural setting for this collection of stories?
Flushing is the second biggest Chinatown in New York City. It also is inhabited by most recent arrivals, not only Chinese. There are a lot of Koreans and European immigrants as well. So it is a vibrant place. In fact, in the beginning of 2005, I was invited to a conference held in the center of Flushing. I was very touched by the scenes on the streets. So that's why I decided to set all the stories in that place.
If you're just joining us, I'm Jackie Lydon, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm talking with the author Ha Jin about his new short story collection, A Good Fall. Mr. Ha Jin, I'd like to ask, I have read very lengthy books of yours that cover a lot of geography, war trash, of course, waiting, and free life. This is a compressed piece. This is like, instead of a big canvas painting, a really compressed, small mosaic. Why did you decide you want to do short stories?
I do feel that, in fact, I'm a better short story writer.
You feel that way?
Yeah, I feel that way. Before this, I had written three volumes of short stories. Each book was set in one place, basically. They are all not linked stories, but they are unified stories for a book. So this book, in a way, followed the same thing I had been doing. Short stories are closer to poetry. So very often one has to compress the stories in order to make it more concise and more poetic in that sense.
It's almost fun, too, when one reads your work, to wonder how much of, in your case, I do this perhaps more than with other authors, how much of your own biographical experience is in it. I mean, you set a lot of these stories in the 1980s. You wrote your first novel or short story in English, I believe, in the mid-1980s, right?
Yes.
And then there was the story that we have in here, which you call Shame. Again, the generational divide between the old and young. A young man is working in between terms, young Chinese man, just getting some money in Manhattan. He's going to school out in Wisconsin, and a professor from China, his old professor, comes to visit and asks him, how much money are you making? And he's so impressed. This guy's just a garment industry worker.
Yes, that's, again, a common story, but it was not autobiographical. I never worked in New York at all. Really, it was different. But again, a lot of details were factual. That was also common when two people met. One of them from the native land would ask how much you make. That was very common. One thing in that episode, in that story, was very true. A teacher of mine went to came to visit the United States and stayed in the Chinese consulate. I went to visit him. I was not allowed to enter the consulate.
Really?
Yes, that was true. From there on, I had never set my foot in that building again.
Oh, you haven't? Have they invited you back at all?
They invited me, but I haven't. I haven't gone to that place.
Why did they tell you that you weren't welcome the last time you tried to go?
Not
there?
Because of me. It's all the visitors,
I see.
The Chinese visitors were just denied access to that building.
In this short story, the professor believes, you know, we're just trying to get at some of how difficult it is to make your way in a new world and bring what you think is important. And there's just one little moment that sort of talks about the divide, in this case, not between old and new generations of Chinese people, but the visiting scholar and his American counterpart, the American professor gives the Chinese professor this beautiful book and collection she's written.
Yes.
And he gives her something kind of a little, shall we say, mass-produced?
It's a mahjong, yes.
The mahjong box.
Yeah. In fact, that's one of the shameful moments for the student. But the professor couldn't feel it.
But the final shame, and I think we can say it here in this one, is that this professor doesn't go home. He defects, stays in this guy's apartment, and leaves behind him work that was his best work on Hemingway. He was going to call it Hemingway in China.
Yeah, it's a secret project the professor aspired to do. But again, it was another bigger shame in a way, yes.
Because it really was shoddy.
Yes. Again, that was based on a fact. I know of people who did a similar thing. Not exactly the same, but similar thing.
When people emigrate or come to America, whether they decide to just go to school here and try and stay on or possibly just choose not to return home, what is the hardest jump? Is it letting go of the past or not being able to understand the present?
You know, all those are hard. The hardest is really to face your own life and be able to take that road. That's the hardest part, because it's a lonely road very often. Freedom also means uncertainty. And a lot of people who grew up in a different kind of a social environment very often can be frightened, intimidated by freedom.
Ha-Jin, it has been a real pleasure having you with us.
Thank you.
Ha-Jin is the author of the new short story collection, A Good Fall. He joined us from member station WBUR in Boston.
Two generations have grown up reading Sandra Boynton or having her simple yet clever books read to them, the Going to Bed book, the Belly Button book. And if you don't know Boynton's kids' books, you might recognize her cartoon animals from the greeting card aisle. She's fond of big, befuddled hippos. Well, now she's branching out, producing music and making short films. B.B. King stars in the first one, singing One Shoe Blues. It's a song from Boynton's CD book collection, Blue Moo. I talked with her about the short film. It comes with its own companion book, and she read it to us.
We might be in Mississippi, or maybe not. Here is somebody's house at the very end of some long and lazy country road on a breezy day in late summer. It's morning.
And there you see the red house.
Which is actually the recording studio where I work in real life.
So
there are lots of cross currents in this project.
And it's surrounded by beautiful woods, and there's an old truck out front. And inside you see a picture of a bed, and it's next to a piano.
Yeah.
And there's a dresser, and there's that owl eye radio right on top of the dresser. And it says, look, no one is sleeping in the little bed of a little house. I think maybe whoever lives here is already awake and up for the day.
And then when you get to the next page, you're seeing more of a close-up on this dresser and the radio. On the dresser near the bed, there's an old clock radio. At exactly 8 o'clock, it clicks on. There follows the curious hum and buzz that an old radio makes when it's warming up. And now we hear a friendly voice saying, and you know what? Blue skies today. Temperatures will be in the high 70s. Right now, how about a little B.B. King?
Yes, I woke up this morning and I couldn't find my shoe.
An old familiar song begins to play.
And there we go. We're off.
Oh, no, the right one is here. I need the left one, too. Yes, I do.
What exactly, I was going to say is, but I guess to be grammatically correct, I need to say what are the One Shoe Blues.
What be the
One Shoe Blues?
The song itself, and certainly the way B.B. King sings it, has a certain ironic quality to it. The child is actually saying he cannot find this shoe and that he's distressed about it, but he's pretty delighted by the whole situation.
Did you look carefully in the closet and under the bed? Yes, yes, I did. Where you left it. That's what my mama said.
What about casting the sock puppets? Because B.B. King is in this short film along with an ensemble, a colorful ensemble.
Since it is about, you know, we wanted to put other cast members in it. Since it's One Shoe Blues, it seemed inevitable that it be sock puppets. And it's almost an infestation of sock puppets. You know, some people have mice, some people have roaches. In this particular house, there seem to be sock puppets.
They pop up everywhere.
They seem to,
those big bug eyes.
Yes.
If you're breaking this up into some kind of percentage, what percentage of this is for the kids and what percentage of it is for the adults?
It's funny. I make no differentiation at all when I'm writing. The things that I love, sometimes I refer to this as the Rocky and Bullwinkle effect, meaning if something is, to me, if it's of value, it should be able to be appreciated by different ages on different levels in different ways.
There it is. I guess it was on my foot all along. Okay, I'm ready to go now.
Sandra Boynton, it's been fun to talk to you. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Sandra Boynton's book is called One Shoe Blues. It's not just a book. It's a book that also includes a short film. And all the way in the back, there is also sheet music for One Shoe Blues. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.